Hi, you are listening to the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. This podcast is for policymakers, governments, researchers, students, businesses, and anyone that is interested in conflict and development issues in Africa. On this podcast, we hear from experts from across Africa and the world. Your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa, will ask the questions you would want answers to. Michael Wangpa has an extensive experience spanning over a decade studying, researching, writing, and consulting on conflict and development issues in Africa.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa. Today we're going to be discussing the United States arms sales to Nigeria and its role in Nigerian government efforts to respond to Boko Haram, ISWAP, and banditry and communal violence in the country. I'm joined by a very special guest, a returning guest, retired Brigadier General Sali Bala, the president at White Inc. Institute for Strategy, Education and Research, WISER, a private defense and security research, strategy, communication and training consultancy firm based in the capital city, Abuja, in Nigeria. General, it's a pleasure to have you back again. I look forward to our conversation.
Dr. Nwakpa, thank you very much for the opportunity.
Brilliant. So let's just start off. So in recent years, we've seen under President Trump, we saw it during his first term. So what we've seen it during his second term now, I think late last year, the United States sold about 1 billion arms sales to Nigeria. I think that they included 12 states of the art Viper attack helicopter. Recently, maybe last month or so, they approved another significant amount, I think about $346 million, including a range of ammunitions, precision bombs, and precision rockets. What are the factors behind these arms sales or buying of arms, this kind of like sophisticated weapons from the United States?
Well, sophisticated is always a word I always argue with people when we speak about weaponry, you know. But I think that will be another conversation for another day. You know, weapons are weapons. The end point, whether they are crude or sophisticated, they terminate human lives, change lifestyles, and destroy civilization. You know, that is, like I said, a conversation another day. But as you know, the academic, you know, life is between realism and idealism. You know, and politics and every factor of human existence is cut between these two houses of thoughts. Depending on the shift of leadership of the US, its perspective on how it approaches the delivery of its national values to strengthen its national values to play out in its international politics always lies between these two areas, whether it is the Republican Party or the Democratic or the Democrats, or if at the rise of any of them you find a leader who is pragmatic in idealism or pragmatic in realism, in the realist school of thought. Personality actually drives governance, as well as you know. Donald Trump is a realist. He believes that might is right, and that progression of his country is in being able to cut deals. This also speaks to his business inclination of his long background. And in fact, survival instinct as both a human, a business person, and as he is today the leader of the most powerful nation in the world. So what we see as oscillations between the ease to sell weapons to Nigeria, or particularly lethal equipment, or not, depends on the party in power and indeed the kind of political leadership. Because as you know, the executive presidency is more the hub of power. It surrounds around the decision, as we are seeing that today you have a realist in power. It could the personality of the president can even trump the power of Congress and even the judiciary. So in whatever kind of blessings that have come upon Nigeria in its relationship, years of relationship with the US, we have had times in our difficult periods where human rights records have been played against us to be able to procure lethal equipment to be able to address our internal and even international challenges. But then indeed, you know, the strategic value of the US in terms of military power cannot be discountenanced. I don't know if you have further questions or
around. Yes, what I want to say is this: why that is correct? Why the United States and Nigeria has always had such shifting military relationship, like rightly observed or analyzed, based on who is in power, the Democrats or the Republicans. We saw during Obama, where based on the Leahy's law, they were prevented from sending
Leahy's law,
and they prevented them from sending the weapons, which by during President Trump's first, they released the helicopters. But then again, there are others that are seen, and I'm also seeing that are seeing this renewed relationship based on U.S. calculation of the changing geopolitical relationship to counter Chinese and Russia's influence in Africa, because see that Chinese are changing their non-interference kind of policy and looking into arming military relationship, and this is seen as effort to counter that. Do you agree with that such argument?
Yeah, absolutely. But wrong malapropism, wrong word to say. Absolutely, but to some extent, that would be true. But also, the internal political dynamics on the Congress itself. For as much as what I have laid earlier, that when you have a strong leader like Trump, he's able to trump actually, the decision of all the other arms of government. But that said, there is a national ethos, there is a national value, which you can only struggle to some extent. And as international relations itself is very nuanced. There is also a lot of posturing in international relations that sometimes it is not the words you say, but actually the actions which follow the action, which follow the words that you may say, or the stand on which you will take on issues. There are relationships where, in spite global ethical or moral standards, there is surreptitious support that goes to nations of interests, across the elements of national power, for them to be able to project force such as to foster the supporting nations' values and interests. So it is almost like a seesaw. Agreed, there are certain posturings which the West, and particularly the leadership of the US, is showing in terms of trying to counter the entry of its identified and defined rivals from the East. There is that to some extent, but as we are seeing from the Nigerian experience, it is more words actually than action. It is more words than action. In this kind of conversation, I always drop in this saying that when your house is on fire, you know, you don't care the quality of water that your neighbor brings in. You know, all you want is water, and not at his own time, but as immediate as possible. You know, argument you will hear from the West is that developing countries will always take the bait from the East, simply because the equipment are cheap, and then the internal politics, human rights dynamics of developing countries are discountenanced. But how do you wait for from equipment you need yesterday for the argumentation on the arena of Congress, and then the decision of the executive on which side on which kind of support and when to lend the support, while you can go to the East and equipment that you need yesterday will be delivered in 5 days time, you know, and without any political strings attached. So I don't know if I've addressed this issue.
Yeah, you have. But if we shift away from the US policies and I'll come to Nigeria itself, there's several questions that I've asked, but let me start with this. We've seen, I think from Buhari, I think during Jonathan lamented the lack of equipment in the fight against Boko Haram. And then I think he then got $1 billion to get a weapon. And when Buhari came, Cornel Dasuki, the national security advisor, was also kind of jailed for cause of like diverting or whatever, not buying whatever. Well, from Buhari, when Buhari came, we saw improved weaponry, we saw all of that. Opposition. But does that match the response to the security, to the level of security? Some will argue and say that hasn't, the increased military equipment and all of this hasn't resolved the security situation. What is this irony? Can you explain that irony or the paradox with that?
Well, my little big friend, General Christopher Musa, has been speaking quite eloquently on this, you know, that military power isn't the one single and overriding factor for dealing with the kind of security challenges we have. You know, it is the political and diplomatic solution. I say diplomatic because of the cross-border and internationalization of the kind of threats that we have, but also the building of internal cohesion, which is the major problem in Nigeria. You know, what happens in the South, in the Southeast, is not the business of the person in the Northwest, and forgive my language, damn it for the person in the Northwest. The problem in the Northwest is not a problem to the person in the South, Southwest, the Southeast, and the South. So war, as you will know it, is follows the triangle of the people, the military, and the politicians. So first things first, if we are not able to build the internal cohesion to deal with our threats, we will not be able to deal with the cross-border issues and even the internationalization of issues on bilateral and multilateral scales. You know, we are not in eating terms anymore with Niger. We cannot ask Mali and Burkina Faso, who we had invested a lot in their political dynamics, including their elections, by supplying them actually vehicles and printing their ballot boxes years past. So it's actually the issues of our internal dynamics and how we are able to play in the greater global international arena that actually speaks to the ability that we're able to have that diplomatic conversation in our favors, to be able to acquire the necessary munitions and platforms that are required for us to be able to do that small 30% effort in dealing with our security challenges, because the most is developmental. And in fact, new debaters like us are factoring the military itself as an element of securing the development. So the military is not a standalone. The military and law enforcement are a factor in securitizing security, safety, and safety, which are the primary prerequisites for advancing development.
There was during same Sambu Dasuki under the fight against Boko Haram. They had the soft approach in 2014, and they had four anchored on four preventing strategic communication, and you know, and which was lauded because they had the development approach that you're talking about in it. But one of the things that I've seen again, and that is the institution that you finished from. When in 2014 or 15, when I was involved in when they had some of the Boko Haram suspects in the prison, I was involved based on my research. What was striking to me is that the military handled virtually every aspect of that, like the psychoanalytical, psychosocial aspect. So it seems that the military has a stronghold even in the soft power approach, where it should be like a civilian arm that should handle that. Do you think our overly militarized approach is because the military has his hands in so many pies? We could also talk about, you know, the internal, you're talking about internal stuff. You talk about the military in the Southeast, the military in this. What's happening to the capacity of the police? So is that what the issue is to some extent?
Oh, well, you've given me a whole broom and you're asking me to... I'll do my best. You know, I never hold back on people on any conversation where we soldiers are always labeled as arrogant. We are not, you know. Mm-hmm. We are not the most pride. We are not. We don't arrogate ourselves.
The most patriotic.
Patriotism, of intellect, of commitment to national development. But then by our culture and our training and our calling, we are trained to work in adversity. We are mission-oriented. And it is always a mistake that civilians do across the world to attempt to tarnish or to exempt the military or even those in retirement to contribute to national development simply because we have the label of being soldiers. That is very, very important for every nation to understand that these are a crop of people who are trained and committed to do nothing but view the nation as their life. And they are trained with such immense capacity where they are focused on mission orientation and mission achievement. And we also have to understand that where you have a situation of adversity, the most appropriate and easier people to develop, to deploy into that are cost effective are soldiers. There are other human elements because we are human as well. So when the military was called to lead, let me emphasize this, to lead the Operation Safe Corridor, people fail to understand that the greater proportion of the actors in the Operation Safe Corridor program are actually civilians, experts in psychosocial disciplines, in correctional, in various fields, in vocational training, and so on and so forth. But what was important was that here are a crop of people who you want to disarm, de-radicalize, demobilize, and reintegrate.
Rehabilitate,
So you actually need that kind of leadership orientation that is militaristic to be able to provide that mission orientation, that regimentation to serve to the operations of that. That's simply what it is. You know, like when we also speak about the dark days of the military, you know, I know my activist friends always speak to that, you know, the dark days of the military. Yeah, it was the dark days of the military. It all depends. It all given to debate.
But then you have the members of the Armed Forces Ruling Council, who you can count them off. There are probably 30 people, and you have the military governors, 36 military governors and the rest. Every advisor, the civil service was in place. Okay, so when we are afraid of finding leadership that is military to lead national service, we also should be considerate about that. I quickly give you an example so that we do not belabor this point because of time. The most successful region of the Green Wall strategy for the Sahel is Senegal. And you know why? Because in Senegal, it is a military operation. It is led by the military. It's a whole unit, two companies with military leadership that is leading that. Why? Because the Sahel, aside being adverse in terms of nature, is also the borderline of the violence across the Sahelian region. So the Sahelian government, in its own wisdom, said, okay, you military, go there and plant the acacias and ensure that you roll back the desert, and it is happening. So it's my little campaign for my constituency, both active and retired, that civilians, we are your servants, okay? And we are humble to the fact that you are our leaders. So don't throw the baby with the bathwater.
No. To be honest with you, in my writings, which is true to some extent, the military, so let me come to Nigerian military. The military itself was not, if you look at a bit of history, did not play a big role in the fight for the independence in Africa. But the military then became important in kind of like preserving that democracy. So which is a bit ironic to some extent. But let's move away from that and move to the point where I'm trying to say that the military itself should, from what you're saying, should not be wholly held to blame. Because like Riley said, in 1979, we had the constituency, the Obasanjo regime, and it was about 250, and there were civilians that were involved in it, lecturers, different places. Also during Abubakar, this in 1979, how did this constituency, which, like I say to you, the elites, I'll call it, is like, usually people will say state capture. And the elites have no, they don't have to wear the military garb. Some of them are academics, some of them are in all of these other places to do that. So I'm not singling out the military. That was not my intention to do that. I'm just saying what I see, that the military seems to, like, we had a guest, you might know him. I forgot his name now. He came, he's also based in Abuja. Last time we were talking about the airstrike in Abuja. And he said that the Minister of Defense does not necessarily have to be a military person. You know, that why can't he be the Minister of Defense? You know, and stuff like that. He was also talking about things like that. So, which I see a point in. But you mentioned something in your last statement about nationalism, patriotism, internal cohesion. So, do you think this is a problem of fundamental problem in the country, nation called Nigeria? Do we have a fundamental problem that needs to be addressed rather than, you know, do we need to address that we've not been able to build a nation?
Yeah, well, you know, there are several institutional attempts by governments, you know, to be able to breed and rise a sense of Nigerianness. You know, I was so glad for the youth. You know, a friend of mine actually yesterday was asking me how did the name Niger, how suddenly did the name Niger spring up? I said, well, it's a move of identity by Gen Z, or even the generation before them, to pride themselves in really what is Nigeria. For as much as it is also the demographic that are most unhappy with Nigeria, you know, with the assumption that Nigeria should suddenly be a first world overnight, and they don't have to be around to build it. Jobs will just be there. Beautiful roads, airplanes will be flying all over the place. You know, you can just walk into the CBN and fill your pockets with dollars and walk out
and dance to.
But Jenna, what's wrong with that? I don't see any problem. I don't think, to be honest, it should be.
No.
Nigeria is that rich. I believe so.
No, there is a lot wrong with that because utopia is not a reality. Okay? Utopia is not a reality. So we can't live a utopian life. Wherever you are, you must work in order to earn. And to earn whatever you enjoy, you must commit yourself and work for it. You know, manna does not fall from heaven. That's the bottom line. It's just a thought from people of my generation, you know. It's an argument because I argue with my sons as well, you know, on this. And it's just a generational fact of life. My kids will tell me, after all, daddy, you know, you went to primary, secondary school, and even to the university, you had a scholarship. And as a rite of passage, immediately you finish NYSC, there were two jobs that were waiting for you. At what stage of Nigeria's development was then? What was the population? What was the number of educated people that Nigeria needed to really take that mountain leap? You know, even Emiratis walk, for God's sake. even Saudians walk. You know, let us be realistic. You know,
but then, I met a professor in Austin, and he used to teach in Ife. He said in 1979, and he was telling me that the pension he collects, he was talking about Nigeria at the time, it was very good. It's greater than whatever I collect in America. There was a time like that. I remember in the early 80s, and so, you know, I'm saying Nigeria has, again, speaking of that, there's something I saw in the papers. I don't know how true it is. It was the Minister of State Defense, Bello Matawalle, the current one. Matawalle was talking about DECON. And people have already talked about DECON. DECON. Like, why is it now that many African countries are now asking DECON to produce? Because I'm kind of challenging what you said about Nigeria is not. Nigeria is actually a giant. It's a sleeping giant, like the director of international NIA said. Is Nigeria still a sleeping giant, not knowing its worth? Is that what it is? Why are we spending billions in sales arms when we have DECON that's been since 1964 that we can develop stuff? And I was listening to Bruce and Senator Bruce, what's his name now? The mistress senator from Rivers. He was talking about the Biafran and how during the Biafran war they had out of necessity develop. Why are we not developing such military infrastructure? So what do you say to that?
It's either you are realistic or you want to romanticize our situation, or you are in a disposition to always have a condemnation syndrome about the stage and the level of our development. You know, Innocent produces vehicles that you find today in Central Africa. Proforce has a 5-year MOU with the government of Niger to supply them MRAPs. It's a 5-year rolling plan. Even the president had a faux pas. Where I watched one of the YouTube videos where he is saying Nigeria doesn't even produce sleepers, you know.
The president said that is
very far from the reality, you know, because when I served in Angola in 1995-96, almost every plastic I saw in Angola, even my visits to Central Africa, had made in Nigeria. Drugs, rob, you know, cigarettes were mostly from Nigeria. Well, of course, we had SFEM and SPAM had its challenges to our development. You know, the most debated IMF intervention in our development during the Babangida
the Babangida days, you know, which also even affected, aside our industry, you know, the prime mover of industry, which is the power sector. So there are all those kind of things over time. And it's so many things, my brother, including international, the global recession, including including democratization itself, you know, because democratization comes with a reversal of either development particularly the development of a nation. I always make references to, I always refer to the great book I read in the War College, Ian Bremmer, The J Curve. And, you know, it's an example of the advent of either post-war development or pre-democratization period, where every aspect of national development actually slumps like the J. And it depends on the new crop of leaders to be able to do the gradual reverse of it at the foot of the J, you know, to climb up to make it a U. So there are so many issues that are out there. There are so many issues out there that really have been, for the lack of a better choice of a word, that have been inimical to sustenance of our democracy. Kagame did not raise his country out of the throes of genocide within 30 years by the romance of liberal democracy to the extent that it is. I always start with a continental example. Malaysia, China today, you are the PhD, so you are the grounded researcher, can tell me in each quarter how many Chinese have been pulled out of poverty, and how many are made millionaires. Speaking to an organization hosted in the United States of America, I don't want to make easy reference to.
I know. But to be honest, that is the truth, and we need to speak truth to where, you know, like in talking about climate change, one of the things I used to say is, Africa contributed just 4%. So why should Africa not industrialize? Africa, half of Africans don't have access to power. So the things you were mentioning are things, like you were saying, and I agree with you, liberal democracy, we come with free markets, and that free market we come with conditions of slowing down exports and, you know, all these imports, and then the devaluation of money and creating all of this issue. But like you rightly said, there were people as well in those continents, like Paul Kagame, that are doing well. So we can't just externalize all of our problem and say, why are we not having leaders that can have our own form of, and people, even serious academics in the West are looking at that Rwandan democracy, type of democracy that's a bit authoritarian democracy or stuff like that can work. And that is one of the things that I've been looking at in this book as well. We should have our own nuanced sort of democracy that works for us, rather than adopting and importing everything Well, let's hone down to you were talking about the Operation Safe Corridor. Yeah, Operation Safe Corridor. There's a book coming. I'll give you my book. When I come to Nigeria, I wrote this, but I don't know if you've seen it, Nigeria's Fourth Republic, 1999-21, A Militarized Democracy. But there's another book coming out that by Indiana University Press called Rethinking Boko Haram. It's an editor that I edited, that I'm looking at. Boko Haram, we're beginning to see resurgence of Boko Haram. So you were talking about internal cohesion, politics, and diplomatic solution to this stuff. But again, I think there's, in my own thinking, when we look at the bandits, how the bandits have been also deployed, there seems to me to be that there's a deliberate attempt not to use these approaches. That even when these approaches are used, they are used not in a way, we're seeing where there have been cases made for ransoms and stuff like that. So rather than addressing governance issues, the issues that these people manipulate to do these things. So I don't know if it's conspiracy, but I think that there is just that deliberation not to address root causes. So I don't know if you agree with that.
Yeah, I respect humanity, you know, for as much as you have, you always will find deviance. Military power, as I have expressed earlier, you know, is just a small percentage of the effort to peace and stability. But military power is one of the elements of national power that must not be served piecemeal. It must be absolute, it must be decisive, and it has to be total. So this is the problem with the military, with the kinetic approach, you know, to combating the kinds of military grade challenges that we have. Mm-hmm. You have an armed force that is under 400,000 in total, the armed force, while you have a police that is under 400,000. Not to talk about those quasi-paramilitary forces. Mm-hmm. You have a military that you can number off the numbers of MRAPs that they have.
Mm-hmm.
You can number off the types of helicopters that are required to do an insurgency, not the jets that we pride ourselves in having, where before the pilot even blinks, you know, the jet would have been kilometers away from the target.
Yeah.
You know, so precisely it is the numbers. You have to have boots enough on the ground. But I always remind people that the factor of first generation, what actually guides for first generation is the assessment of the threat as can be capacitated by the state of the economy. If to prepare one troop, one soldier, as a 2017 bills, if to prepare one soldier for a counterinsurgency, just for personal equipment, you need $30,000 to equip one soldier. And you need to deploy 500,000 soldiers. I wonder the kind of economy that will be able to accommodate that. And to be assured that once you get into combat, you know, you can get a 5% loss in 1 week. So you need to be economically capable to be able to replace or replenish. This is war economics. And even if you have the internal capacity to be able to produce, we are seeing what is happening to Russia and Ukraine, and even Israel, you also need that robust diplomatic capacity to be able to do the international relations, to be able to secure your lines of replenishment. So these are the big things that are about. One, we have a very, very infant political community. To some extent, with due respect, we have politicians who are really naive to international relations and are completely ignorant about military diplomacy. And that is exactly what led us into the logjam that led to the split of ECOWAS under the leadership of a Nigerian chair of ECOWAS. And the breaking of a historic generational relationship that we have had with our closest ally in the region, which is Niger. So the component of the nation in especially fighting the most critical security challenge that Nigeria today faces are the threats in the Northwest, and the north and the northeast
east.
And the northeast, which the challenge of the North Central is only an opportunity out of the problems we have in the Northwest and the Northeast, which relates to the problems of the Greater Sahel. The Boko Haram issue is fed from the insecurities of the Eastern Sahel, which starts, of course, from Chad into Sudan and all the way to Eritrea, which is the into the Indian Ocean. So we cannot afford to be naive to the politics of the entire countries of those nations, just as already we are naive to the politics of the Sahelian region. So these are the issues. It's a mix of mercantilism, which feeds politics, and also absolute ignorance of what the nexus is between what the nexus is for results in having a robust internal dynamic and a dynamic and cohesion with international relations.
Before I come to the last question, I would just do best to address what you've just mentioned. So there's a bit of something. I agree with most of what you said, but there's another thing I find would be shocking that you mentioned. You mentioned the number of soldiers. About, you said 500,000 soldiers are needed. And I was thinking, in contemporary terms, where there's now like a shift towards other forms, AI, other forms of like precision stuff, the people are talking about less number, soldiers, and we're still talking about numbers. So I wanted to address that. Then the other thing we're talking about also is Nigeria has not been able, in Nigeria's defense policy or military policy or foreign policy, we've always had a domestic, regional, and we've always focused more trying to be the big brother Africa. We've always do, like you already said, in Angola, in Sierra Leone, in Liberia, you know, Nigeria played a much bigger role in restoring, intervening in those countries. But they've not translated that in domestic, at the domestic level. So why is this so? People will look at, why is Nigeria able to operate at that level? So I don't want to say it's political naivety to some point. I would say, again, we've operated at those levels, regional level, international level. Nigeria supplies, I think, the fourth highest supply of military to the United Nations interventions in many of these places. So we have those kind of experiences, but why is it not translating domestically in our own domestic security issues?
Yeah, well, again, nothing is absolute, and I think Nigeria is still a force to reckon with. It is not only Burna Boy and
David
reckon with in Nigeria, you know, an IRS star. I don't know if she's South African or Nigeria, but I know my children are crazy about it, and everywhere in the world, it is danced to. And
but that is good too, and generally, the diplomatic approach as well, a soft approach as well.
I'm not being condescending, because it's a force. It's indeed a major force, because it gives recognition to the nation. Wherever you go and you say Nigeria, wherever I go, people will ask me, especially in East and Central Africa and Southern Africa, people still approach me and say, do you know Aki and Popo?
yeah.
You know, that's the force of Nigeria. And I like your dress. And people will always say, you know what I like about you Nigerians is the fact that in international meetings, everybody is in suit and tie, but you come in here with your with your nightcap and a feather. No, so that's a force. But speaking on a lighter but very very serious mood, the internal challenges, the internal political and security challenges, has really drawn
Nigeria back from its spawning power across the continent. But you can yet never diminish the economic power of Nigeria and its influence. In spite of the fact that in international relations, you know, people will rather go and speak to Ghanaians, they will rather speak with Ethiopians, you know, but at the end, you always prod them to say, please, so get Nigerians. Because, you know, nothing can happen without money, you know? My good Igbo friends will say, ego na chego, you know? Nigeria has really not lost its kahunas, you know, but we have immense internal challenges. The foremost, as I always tell people, is internal cohesion. That internal bond. We still play the sentiments of you hear Nigerians, education, with their all their education and international accomplishment, will still tell you that Nigeria is a geographical expression. We still tell you that by 1940, whatever, when I don't even bother to know when the Northern Protectorate and the Southern Protectorate were brought together, that they were not consulted. There were railroads, there were radios, there wasn't social media where you can put out an idea and everybody will vote into it. We've been brought together, and that is what is important. It is not to say we cannot reverse it, but we should be able to sit and have a conversation on how it is going to be. We should be able to appreciate how we have gone across Nigeria by tribes, by tongues, and we are able to establish a nation that we should be proud of. I don't want to be a member of any nation where my flight is not 1 hour or beyond it. I don't want to fly 5 minutes and I'm at the end of my country. No. No. Okay? I don't want to go to an international forum and international people are confused because there are 10 Nigerians and they are all dressed differently, but we are one people. You know, I give this example when I was in War College. We were five Nigerians from different regions of Nigeria. And on the day of International Day, all the other international people were confused. I was dressed differently. The Igbo officer was dressed differently. The Igbo guy was looking funny. The Karuri guy, even as a northern Nigerian, was looking differently. But that is the power of Nigeria. Okay? But to come to the argument, for as much as Nigeria has retained its power, I am proud of that, you know. The moment we are able to deal with our internal dynamics and build that cohesion and identity as Nigeria, people say only football that unites us. That's a lie. Because when Eric Chell brings out his team list, why are there only Igbos? Where are Hausas?
Where are the Igbos?
Don't play football. Leave Igbos to play football for us. And the few Yorubas who play it. That is the way it goes. You know, we also have our own riches that we contribute to the nation. So as long as we're not able to build internal cohesion, even for industries, we will only be begging the point. You know, the Dangote brand is a Nigerian brand. It is in 11 countries of Nigeria, of Africa.
Just Africa.
It supplies PMS to the great United States of America. I think for Nigeria, but now we are beginning to have petroleum products sovereignty. And this is the kind of direction that we should be looking at as Nigerians, because we will consistently and ever remain a force to be reckoned with in Africa for as long as we're able to deal with our very simple internal challenges. You know, I may not have addressed the question.
Jenna, you've done. Yeah, go on. I think you've done.
Yeah, because you also raised the issue of technology, of technology and
the 500 million need for 5 million switches. Mm.
Whatever you do in any kind of generation of war, we are in the fourth and slipping into fifth generation of war where technology is taking over. But primarily, whatever you fight, if you are not able to hold the ground.
Mm.
If you are not able to hold the ground, which in itself is the primary effort at seizing sovereignty, at holding sovereignty, as defending sovereignty, as projecting sovereignty. So whatever you do, whatever kinds of drones and intercontinental ballistic missiles that China was able to arrogantly show the West last week.
Mm.
The first column of power that was demonstrated was the human element.
Number, yeah.
Was the thousands of well-orchestrated ground forces.
Mm.
So you can have all the drones, you can have all the kamikaze drones, you can fly 500,000 kamikazes, which can be eliminated in matter of minutes, but you still need the humans, because the human terrain is the heart of sovereignty.
Mm.
So as much as Nigeria should be able to scale up its human power to be able to occupy those ungoverned spaces, of course, we need technology to be able to pinpoint where these are, and we're able to deliver lethal power in response to what intelligence has provided to us. And you just fire and forget. Immediately you deal with it, you need troops to be able to hold the ground.
I agree. Colonel, unfortunately, we're running out of time. I you know, our conversation is always very interesting. I think we have another one where you would I'll get into, you know, where you provide practical ways. I have some ideas where we can build that bond. Like Realis, I like how you say it's simple. It's actually, I say a general problem, it might look complex, but it's actually simple, where we can build that thing that is holding us together, holding us. Because for me, I eat different soup. They can come from the Calabar. I eat this from this. It's a beauty in that unity. So that's what gives us that I wanted to maintain like that. But thank you very much, sir, for your time,
Doctor,
your insight.
Doctor, I think a point I need to add is the security challenges has really been met by immense domestic innovation and creativity. Today, I've already mentioned ProForce. Today, you have up to 11 companies in Nigeria building drones.
Mm. Okay, and this is besides the government, these are private companies.
Yeah, beside the Nigerian Air Force, beside the Nigerian Army, beside Naseni, who are doing great things. You will be shocked what Nigerians are.
Then I'll get in touch with you again, which is very interesting. Yes. My friend and I don't know if you know him, he's based in Cambridge. We are writing a book for Routledge. We've got a contract to write a book, Military and Warfare in Africa. And we think that the justice has not been done enough to the African continent, development of Air Force and all of that. So you saying this now, you know, is making me see the reality of that, which is true.
And, you know, Doctor, when we speak about the military industrial complex, what comes to our mind always is munitions.
Hmm.
Ammunition, bombs, aircraft, and so on and so forth. What about the textile industry? What are the shoes? Hmm. What about the boots?
Hmm.
What about the accoutrements?
What about Dangote that is there ready as a strategic supplier of petroleum, oil, and lubricants by which even Boko Haram and Laukurawa and Musawa cannot move? These are important dynamics. What about civil engineering in Nigeria that will build roads and be able to provide that ability for us to move and reach threat areas? So the military industrial complex is complex, you know, it is, and it's so much in Nigeria to appreciate. And we have loads of them. So maybe in another conversation, we'll
definitely talk about that. But thank you very much, sir, for this very, very exposing and revealing insight. I really, really appreciate that. Yeah, thank you very much, sir. Sorry for yesterday for the mix-up. I really, really appreciate it. It's worth it.
No, that's all right. And I'm glad I am being hosted we should celebrate the century episode. You know that I
yes, I was gonna say that. You know, I went back and you were one of the earlier. You came in episode 16. And now this is very significant. I was gonna
congratulations indeed, Dr. Mwapa. Yeah.
Thank you very much, sir. Thank you very much, sir. All right. Have a very brilliant, great day. Bye.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Bye.
Thank you for tuning in to our very 100th episode. Thank you. Join me to thank our returning guests and very good, I can say my very good friend, senior colleague, Brigadier General Salibali, for his very great insights into this topic. For now, stay blessed and I'll see you next week.